obligations with respect to the Supply Corps. Residents must be prepared to help with office work at all times. Baths. The wash tub is available to all residents after 9 a.m. on Sundays. Residents may bathe in the bathroom, kitchen, private office, or front office as they choose. Alcohol, for medicinal purposes only. The end. Yours, Anne. Thursday, November 19th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, just as we thought, Mr. Dussel is a very nice man. Of course, he didn't mind sharing a room with me. To be honest, I'm not exactly delighted at having a stranger use my things, but you have to make sacrifices for a good cause, and I'm glad I can make this small one. If we can save even one of our friends, the rest doesn't matter, said Father, and he's absolutely right. The first day Mr. Dussel was here, he asked me all sorts of questions. For example, what time the cleaning lady comes to the office, how we've arranged to use the washroom, and when we're allowed to go to the toilet. You may laugh, but these things aren't so easy in a hiding place. During the daytime, we can't make any noise that might be heard downstairs, and when someone else is there, like the cleaning lady, we have to be extra careful. I patiently explained all this to Mr. Dussel, but I was surprised to see how slow he is to catch on. He asks everything twice and still can't remember what you've told him. Maybe he's just confused by the sudden change and he'll get over it. Otherwise, everything is going fine. Mr. Dussel has told us much about the outside world we've missed for so long. He had sad news. Countless friends and acquaintances have been taken off to a dreadful fate. Night after night, green and gray military vehicles cruise the streets. They knock on every door, asking whether any Jews live there. If so, the whole family is immediately taken away. If not, they proceed to the next house. It's impossible to escape their clutches unless you go into hiding. They often go around with lists, knocking only on those doors where they know there's a big haul to be made. They frequently offer a bounty, so much per head. It's like the slave hunts of the olden days. I don't mean to make light of this. It's much too tragic for that. In the evenings when it's dark, I often see long lines of good, innocent people accompanied by crying children, walking on and on, ordered about by a handful of men who bully and beat them until they nearly drop. No one is spared. The sick, the elderly, children, babies, and pregnant women, all are marched to their death. We're so fortunate here, away from the turmoil. We wouldn't have to give a moment's thought to all this suffering if it weren't for the fact that we're so worried about those we hold dear, whom we can no longer help. I feel wicked sleeping in a warm bed, while somewhere out there my dearest friends are dropping from exhaustion or being knocked to the ground. I get frightened myself when I think of close friends who are now at the mercy of the cruelest monsters ever to stalk the earth, and all because they're Jews. Yours, Anne. Friday, November 20th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, we don't really know how to react. Up to now, every little news about the Jews had reached us here, and we thought it best to stay as cheerful as possible. Every now and then, Meep used to mention what had happened to a friend, and Mother or Mrs. Van Dam would start to cry, so she decided it was better not to say anymore. But we bombarded Mr. Dussel with questions, and the stories he had to tell were so gruesome and dreadful that we can't get them out of our heads. Once we've had time to digest the news, we'll probably go back to our usual joking and teasing. It won't do us or those outside any good if we continue to be as gloomy as we are now. And what would be the point of turning the secret annex into a melancholy annex? No matter what I'm doing, I can't help thinking about those who are gone. I catch myself laughing, and I remember that it's a disgrace to be so cheerful. But am I supposed to spend the whole day crying? No, I can't do that. This gloom will pass. Added to this misery, there's another, but of a more personal nature, and it pales in comparison to the suffering I've just told you about. Still, I can't help telling you that lately I've begun to feel deserted. I'm surrounded by too great a void. I never used to give it much thought, since my mind was filled with my friends and having a good time. Now I think either about unhappy things or about myself. It's taken a while, but I finally realized that Father, no matter how kind he may be, can't take the place of my former world. When it comes to my feelings, Mother and Margot ceased to count long ago. But why do I bother you with this foolishness? I'm terribly ungrateful, Kitty, I know. But when I've been scolded for the umpteenth time and have all these other woes to think about as well, my head begins to reel. Yours, Anne. Saturday, November 28th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, we've been using too much electricity and have now exceeded our ration. The result? Excessive economy and the prospect of having the electricity cut off. No light for 14 days. That's a pleasant thought, isn't it? But who knows, maybe it won't be so long. It's too dark to read after 4 or 4:30, so we while away the time with all kinds of crazy activities. Telling riddles, doing calisthenics in the dark, speaking English or French, reviewing books. After a while, everything gets boring. Yesterday, I discovered a new pastime, using a good pair of binoculars to peek into the lighted rooms of the neighbors. During the day, our curtains can't be opened, not even an inch, but there's no harm when it's so dark. I never knew that neighbors could be so interesting. Ours are, at any rate. I've come across a few at dinner, one family making home movies and the dentist across the way working on a frightened old lady. Mr. Dussel, the man who is said to get along so well with children and to absolutely adore them, has turned out to be an old-fashioned disciplinarian and preacher of unbearably long sermons on manners. Since I have the singular pleasure of sharing my far too narrow room with His Excellency, and since I'm generally considered to be the worst behaved of the three young people, it's all I can do to avoid having the same old scoldings and admonitions repeatedly flung at my head and to pretend not to hear. This wouldn't be so bad if Mr. Dussel weren't such a tattletale, hadn't singled out Mother to be the recipient of his reports. If Mr. Dussel's just read me the riot act, Mother lectures me all over again, this time throwing the whole book at me. And if I'm really lucky, Mrs. Van D. calls me to account 5 minutes later and lays down the law as well. Really, it's not easy being the badly brought up center of attention of a family of nitpickers. In bed at night, as I ponder my many sins and exaggerated shortcomings, I get so confused by the sheer amount of things I have to consider that I either laugh or cry, depending on my mood. Then I fall asleep with the strange feeling of wanting to be different than I am, or being different than I want to be, or perhaps of behaving differently than I am or want to be. Oh dear, now I'm confusing you too. Forgive me, but I don't like crossing things out, and in these times of scarcity, tossing away a piece of paper is clearly taboo. So I can only advise you not to reread the above passage and to make no attempt to get to the bottom of it, because you'll never find your way out again. Yours, Anne. Monday, December 7th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Hanukkah and St. Nicholas Day nearly coincided this year. They were only one day apart. We didn't make much of a fuss with Hanukkah, merely exchanging a few small gifts and lighting the candles. Since candles are in short supply, we lit them for only 10 minutes. But as long as we sing the song, that doesn't matter. Mr. Van Dan made a menorah out of wood, so that was taken care of, too. St. Nicholas Day on Saturday was much more fun. During dinner, Bep and Meep were so busy whispering to Father that our curiosity was aroused, and we suspected they were up to something. Sure enough, at 8 o'clock, we all trooped downstairs through the hall in pitch darkness. It gave me the shivers, and I wished I was safely back upstairs. To the alcove. We could switch on the light, since this room doesn't have any windows. When that was done, Father opened the big cabinet. Oh, how wonderful! We all cried. In the corner was a large basket decorated with colorful paper and a mask of Black Peter. We quickly took the basket upstairs with us. Inside was a little gift for everyone, including an appropriate verse. Since you're familiar with the kinds of poems people write each other on St. Nicholas Day, I won't copy them down for you. I received a Cupid doll, Father got bookends, and so on. Well, anyway, it was a nice idea, and since the 8 of us never celebrated St. Nicholas Day before, this was a good time to begin. Yours, Anne. P.S. We also had presents for everyone downstairs. A few things left over from the good old days. Plus, Meep and Bep are always grateful for money. Today we heard that Mr. Van Dan's ashtray, Mr. Dussel's picture frame, and Father's bookends were made by none other than Mr. Foskell. How anyone can be so clever with his hands is a mystery to me. Thursday, December 10th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Mr. Van Dan used to be in the meat, sausage, and spice business. He was hired for his knowledge of spices, and yet, to our great delight, it's his sausage talents that have come in handy now. We ordered a large amount of meat, under the counter, of course, that we were planning to preserve in case there were hard times ahead. Mr. Van Dan decided to make bratwurst, sausages, and metwurst. I had fun watching him put the meat through the grinder once, twice, three times. Then he added the remaining ingredients to the ground meat and used a long pipe to force the mixture into the casings. We ate the bratwurst with sauerkraut for lunch, but the sausages, which were going to be canned, had to dry first, so we hung them over a pole suspended from the ceiling. Everyone who came into the room burst into laughter when they saw the dangling sausages. It was such a comical sight. The kitchen was a shambles. Mr. Van Dan, clad in his wife's apron and looking fatter than ever, was working away at the meat. What with his bloody hands, red face, and spotted apron, he looked like a real butcher. Mrs. Van D was trying to do everything at once, learning Dutch out of a book, stirring the soup, watching the meat, sighing and moaning about her broken rib. That's what happens when old ladies do such stupid exercises to get rid of their fat behinds. Dussel had an eye infection and was sitting next to the stove dabbing his eye with chamomile tea. Pim, seated in the one ray of sunshine coming through the window, kept having to move his chair this way and that to stay out of the way. His rheumatism must have been bothering him because he was slightly hunched over and was keeping an eye on Mr. Van Dan with an agonized expression on his face. He reminded me of those aged invalids you see in the poorhouse. Peter was romping around the room with Mushi, the cat, while Mother, Margot, and I were peeling boiled potatoes. When you get right down to it, none of us were doing our work properly, because we were all so busy watching Mr. Van Dam. Dussel has opened his dental practice. Just for fun, I'll describe the session with his very first patient. Mother was ironing, and Mrs. Van D, the first victim, sat down on a chair in the middle of the room. Dussel, unpacking his case with an air of importance, asked for some eau de cologne, which could be used as a disinfectant, and Vaseline, which would have to do for wax. He looked in Mrs. Van D's mouth and found two teeth that made her wince with pain and utter incoherent cries every time he touched them. After a lengthy examination, lengthy as far as Mrs. Van D was concerned, since it actually took no longer than 2 minutes, Dussel began to scrape out a cavity. But Mrs. Van D had no intention of letting him. She flailed her arms and legs until Dussel finally let go of his probe, and it remained stuck in Mrs. Van D's tooth. That really did it. Mrs. Van D lashed out wildly in all directions, cried as much as you can with an instrument like that in your mouth, tried to remove it, but only managed to push it in even farther. Mr. Dussel calmly observed the scene, his hands on his hips, while the rest of the audience roared with laughter. Of course, that was very mean of us. If it had been me, I'm sure I would have yelled even louder. After a great deal of squirming, kicking, screaming, and shouting, Mrs. Van D finally managed to yank the thing out, and Mr. Dussel went on with his work as if nothing had happened. He was so quick that Mrs. Van D didn't have time to pull any more shenanigans. But then he had more help than he's ever had before, no fewer than two assistants. Mr. Van D and I performed our job well. The whole scene resembled one of those engravings from the Middle Ages entitled A Quack at Work. In the meantime, however, the patient was getting restless, since she had to keep an eye on her soup and her food. One thing is certain, it'll be a while before Mrs. Van D makes another dental appointment. Yours, Anne. Sunday, December 13th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, I'm sitting here nice and cozy in the front office, peering out through a chink in the heavy curtains. It's dusky, but there's just enough light to write by. It's really strange watching people walk past. They all seem to be in such a hurry that they nearly trip over their own feet. Those on bicycles whiz by so fast, I can't even tell who's on the bike. The people in this neighborhood aren't particularly attractive to look at. The children especially are so dirty you wouldn't want to touch them with a 10-foot pole. Real slum kids with runny noses. I can hardly understand a word they say. Yesterday afternoon, when Margot and I were taking a bath, I said, "What if we took a fishing rod and reeled in each of those kids one by one as they walked by, stuck them in the tub, washed and mended their clothes, and then tomorrow they'd be just as dirty and tattered as they were before," Margot replied. But I'm babbling. There are also other things to look at. Cars, boats, and the rain. I can hear the streetcar and the children, and I'm enjoying myself. Our thoughts are subject to as little change as we are. They're like a merry-go-round, turning from the Jews to food, from food to politics. By the way, speaking of Jews, I saw two yesterday when I was peeking through the curtains. I felt as though I were gazing at one of the seven wonders of the world. It gave me such a funny feeling, as if I'd denounced them to the authorities and was now spying on their misfortune. Across from us is a houseboat. The captain lives there with his wife and children. He has a small yapping dog. We know the little dog only by its bark and by its tail, which we can see whenever it runs around the deck. Oh, what a shame. It's just started raining, and most of the people are hidden under their umbrellas. All I can see are raincoats, and now and again the back of a stocking-capped head. Actually, I don't even need to look. By now I can recognize the women at a glance, gaunt to fat from eating potatoes, dressed in a red or green coat and worn-out shoes, a shopping bag dangling from their arms with faces that are either grim or good-humored, depending on the mood of their husbands. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, December 22nd, 1942. Dearest Kitty, the Annex was delighted to hear that we'll all be receiving an extra quarter pound of butter for Christmas. According to the newspaper, everyone is entitled to half a pound, but they mean those lucky souls who get their ration books from the government, not Jews in hiding like us, who can only afford to buy 4 rather than 8 ration books on the black market. Each of us is going to bake something with the butter. This morning, I made 2 cakes and a batch of cookies. It's very busy upstairs, and Mother has informed me that I'm not to do any studying or reading until all the household chores have been finished. Mrs. Van Dan is lying in bed nursing her bruised rib. She complains all day long, constantly demands that the bandages be changed, and is generally dissatisfied with everything. I'll be glad when she gets back on her feet and can clean up after herself, because, I must admit, she's extraordinarily hard-working and neat, and as long as she's in good physical and mental condition, she's quite cheerful. As if I don't hear shh, shh enough during the day because I'm always making too much noise, my dear roommate has come up with the idea of saying shh, shh to me all night, too. According to him, I shouldn't even turn over. I refuse to take any notice of him, and the next time he shushes me, I'm going to shush him right back. He gets more exasperating and egotistical as the days go by. Except for the first week, I haven't seen even one of the cookies he so generously promised me. He's particularly infuriating on Sundays, when he switches on the light at the crack of dawn to exercise for 10 minutes. To me, the torment seems to last for hours, since the chairs I use to make my bed longer are constantly being jiggled under my sleepy head. After rounding off his limbering up exercises with a few vigorous arm swings, his lordship begins dressing. His underwear is hanging on a hook, so first he lumbers over to get it, and then lumbers back past my bed. But his tie is on the table, so once again he pushes and bumps his way past the chairs. But I mustn't waste any more of your time griping about disgusting old men. It won't help matters anyway. My plans for revenge, such as unscrewing the light bulb, locking the door and hiding his clothes, have unfortunately had to be abandoned in the interests of peace. Oh, I'm becoming so sensible. We've got to be reasonable about everything we do here. Studying, listening, holding our tongues, helping others, being kind, making compromises, and I don't know what else. I'm afraid my common sense, which is in short supply to begin with, will be used up too quickly, and I won't have any left by the time the war is over. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, January 13th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, this morning I was constantly interrupted, and as a result, I haven't been able to finish a single thing I've begun. We have a new pastime, namely filling packages with powdered gravy. The gravy is one of Giesen Company's products. Mr. Kugler hasn't been able to find anyone else to fill the packages, and besides, it's cheaper if we do the job. It's the kind of work they do in prisons. It's incredibly boring and makes us dizzy and giggly. Terrible things are happening outside. At any time of night and day, poor, helpless people are being dragged out of their homes. They're allowed to take only a knapsack and a little cash with them, and even then, they're robbed of these possessions on the way. Families are torn apart. Men, women, and children are separated. Children come home from school to find that their parents have disappeared. Women return from shopping to find their houses sealed, their families gone. The Christians in Holland are also living in fear, because their sons are being sent to Germany. Everyone is scared. Every night, hundreds of planes pass over Holland on their way to German cities to sow their bombs on German soil. Every hour, hundreds or maybe even thousands of people are being killed in Russia and Africa. No one can keep out of the conflict. The entire world is at war, and even though the Allies are doing better, the end is nowhere in sight. As for us, we're quite fortunate. Luckier than millions of people. It's quiet and safe here, and we're using our money to buy food. We're so selfish that we talk about after the war and look forward to new clothes and shoes, when actually we should be saving every penny to help others when the war is over, to salvage whatever we can. The children in this neighborhood run around in thin shirts and wooden shoes. They have no coats, no socks, no caps, and no one to help them. Gnawing on a carrot to still their hunger pains, they walk from their cold houses through cold streets to an even colder classroom. Things have gotten so bad in Holland that hordes of children stop passers-by in the streets to beg for a piece of bread. I could spend hours telling you about the suffering the war has brought, but I'd only make myself more miserable. All we can do is wait, as calmly as possible, for it to end. Jews and Christians alike are waiting. The whole world is waiting, and many are waiting for death. Yours, Anne. Saturday, January 30th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, I'm seething with rage, yet I can't show it. I'd like to scream, stamp my foot, give Mother a good shaking, cry, and I don't know what else because of the nasty words, mocking looks, and accusations that she hurls at me day after day, piercing me like arrows from a tightly strung bow, which are nearly impossible to pull from my body. I'd like to scream at Mother Margot the Van Dans, Dussel, and Father, too. Leave me alone! Let me have at least one night when I don't cry myself to sleep with my eyes burning and my head pounding. Let me get away, away from everything, away from this world. But I can't do that. I can't let them see my doubts or the wounds they've inflicted on me. I couldn't bear their sympathy or their good-humored derision. It would only make me want to scream even more. Everyone thinks I'm showing off when I talk. Ridiculous when I'm silent, insolent when I answer, cunning when I have a good idea, lazy when I'm tired, selfish when I eat one more bite than I should, stupid, cowardly, calculating, etc., etc. All day long I hear nothing but what an exasperating child I am, and although I laugh it off and pretend not to mind, I do mind. I wish I could ask God to give me another personality, one that doesn't antagonize everyone. But that's impossible. I'm stuck with the character I was born with, and yet I'm sure I'm not a bad person. I do my best to please everyone, more than they'd ever suspect in a million years. When I'm upstairs, I try to laugh it off because I don't want them to see my troubles. More than once, after a series of absurd reproaches, I've snapped at Mother. I don't care what you say. Why don't you just wash your hands of me? I'm a hopeless case. Of course, she'd tell me not to talk back and virtually ignore me for 2 days. Then suddenly all would be forgotten and she'd treat me like everyone else. It's impossible for me to be all smiles one day and venomous the next. I'd rather choose the golden mean, which isn't so golden, and keep my thoughts to myself. Perhaps someday I'll treat the others with the same contempt as they treat me. Oh, if only I could. Yours, Anne. Friday, February 5th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, though it's been ages since I've written to you about the squabbles, there's still no change. In the beginning, Mr. Dussel took our soon-forgotten clashes very seriously, but now he's grown used to them and no longer tries to mediate. Margot and Peter aren't exactly what you'd call young. They're both so quiet and boring. Next to them, I stick out like a sore thumb, and I'm always being told, "Margot and Peter don't act that way. Why don't you follow your sister's example?" I hate that. I confess that I have absolutely no desire to be like Margot. She's too weak-willed and passive to suit me. She lets herself be swayed by others and always backs down under pressure. I want to have more spunk, but I keep ideas like these to myself. They'd only laugh at me if I offered this in my defense. During meals, the air is filled with tension. Fortunately, the outbursts are sometimes held in check by the soup eaters, the people from the office who come up to have a cup of soup for lunch. This afternoon, Mr. Van Dan again brought up the fact that Margot eats so little. "I suppose you do it to keep your figure," he added in a mocking tone. Mother, who always comes to Margot's defense, said in a loud voice, "I can't stand that stupid chatter of yours a minute longer." Mrs. Van D turned red as a beet. Mr. Van D stared straight ahead and said nothing. Still, we often have a good laugh. Not long ago, Mrs. Van D was entertaining us with some bit of nonsense or another. She was talking about the past, about how well she got along with her father and what a flirt she was. "And you know," she continued, "my father told me that if a gentleman ever got fresh, I was to say, 'Remember, sir, that I'm a lady,' and he'd know what I meant." We split our sides laughing, as if she'd told us a good joke. Even Peter, though he's usually quiet, occasionally gives rise to hilarity. He has the misfortune of adoring foreign words without knowing what they mean. One afternoon, we couldn't use the toilet because there were visitors in the office. Unable to wait, he went to the bathroom but didn't flush the toilet. To warn us of the unpleasant odor, he tacked a sign to the bathroom door. RSVP, gas. Of course, he meant danger, gas, but he thought RSVP looked more elegant. He didn't have the faintest idea that it meant please reply. Yours, Anne. Saturday, February 27th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, Pym is expecting the invasion any day now. Churchill has had pneumonia but is gradually getting better. Gandhi, the champion of Indian freedom, is on one of his umpteenth hunger strikes. Mrs. Van D claims she's fatalistic, but who's the most afraid when the guns go off? None other than Petronella Van Damme. Jan brought along the Episcopal letter that the bishops addressed to their parishioners. It was beautiful and inspiring. People of the Netherlands, stand up and take action. Each of us must choose our own weapons to fight for the freedom of our country, our people, and our religion. Give your help and support. Act now. This is what they're preaching from the pulpit. Will it do any good? It's definitely too late to help our fellow Jews. Guess what's happened to us now? The owner of the building sold it without informing Mr. Kugler and Mr. Kleiman. One morning, the new landlord arrived with an architect to look the place over. Thank goodness Mr. Kleiman was in the office. He showed the gentleman all there was to see, with the exception of the secret annex. He claimed he'd left the key at home, and the new owner asked no further questions. If only he doesn't come back demanding to see the annex. In that case, we'll be in big trouble. Father emptied a card file for Margot and me and filled it with index cards that are blank on one side. This is to become our reading file, in which Margot and I are supposed to note down the books we've read, the author, and the date. I've learned two new words, brothel and coquette. I bought a separate notebook for new words. There's a new division of butter and margarine. Each person is to get their portion on their own plate. The distribution is very unfair. The Van Dans, who always make breakfast for everyone, give themselves 1.5 times more than they do us. My parents are much too afraid of an argument to say anything, which is a shame, because I think people like that should always be given a taste of their own medicine. Yours, Anne. Thursday, March 4th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, Mrs. Van D has a new nickname. We've started calling her Mrs. Beaverbrook. Of course, that doesn't mean anything to you, so let me explain. A certain Mr. Beaverbrook often talks on the English radio about what he considers to be the far too lenient bombardment of Germany. Mrs. Van Dam, who always contradicts everyone, including Churchill and the news reports, is in complete agreement with Mr. Beaverbrook. So we thought it would be a good idea for her to be married to him, and since she was flattered by the notion, we've decided to call her Mrs. Beaverbrook from now on. We're getting a new warehouse employee, since the old one is being sent to Germany. That's bad for him, but good for us, because the new one won't be familiar with the building. We're still afraid of the men who work in the warehouse. Gandhi is eating again. The black market is doing a booming business. If we had enough money to pay the ridiculous prices, we could stuff ourselves silly. Our greengrocer buys potatoes from the Wehrmacht and brings them in sacks to the private office. Since he suspects we're hiding here, he makes a point of coming during lunchtime when the warehouse employees are out. So much pepper is being ground at the moment that we sneeze and cough with every breath we take. Everyone who comes upstairs greets us with an achoo. Mrs. Van D swears she won't go downstairs. One more whiff of pepper and she's going to get sick. I don't think Father has a very nice business. Nothing but pectin and pepper. As long as you're in the food business, why not make candy? A veritable thunderstorm of words came crashing down on me again this morning. The air flashed with so many coarse expressions that my ears were ringing with Anne's bad this and Van Dan's good that. Fire and brimstone. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, March 10th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, We had a short circuit last night, and besides that, the guns were booming away until dawn. I still haven't gotten over my fear of planes and shooting, and I crawl into Father's bed nearly every night for comfort. I know it sounds childish, but wait till it happens to you. The ack-ack guns make so much noise you can't hear your own voice. Mrs. Beaverbrook, the fatalist, practically burst into tears and said in a timid little voice, "Oh, it's so awful. Oh, the guns are so loud," which is another way of saying, "I'm so scared." It didn't seem nearly as bad by candlelight as it did in the dark. I was shivering as if I had a fever and begged Father to relight the candle. He was adamant there was to be no light. Suddenly we heard a burst of machine gun fire, and that's 10 times worse than anti-aircraft guns. Mother jumped out of bed, and to Pim's great annoyance, lit the candle. Her resolute answer to his grumbling was, "After all, Anne is not an ex-soldier." And that was the end of that. Have I told you any of Mrs. Van D's other fears? I don't think so. To keep you up to date on the latest adventures in the secret annex, I should tell you this as well. One night, Mrs. Van D thought she heard loud footsteps in the attic, and she was so afraid of burglars she woke her husband. At that very same moment, the thieves disappeared, and the only sound Mr. Van D could hear was the frightened pounding of his fatalistic wife's heart. "Oh, Pootie," she cried. Pootie is Mrs. Van D's pet name for her husband. "They must have taken all our sausages and dried beans, and what about Peter? Oh, do you think Peter's still safe and sound in his bed?" "I'm sure they haven't stolen Peter. Stop being such a ninny and let me get back to sleep." Impossible. Mrs. Van D was too scared to sleep. A few nights later, the entire Van Dan family was awakened by ghostly noises. Peter went to the attic with a flashlight and scurry, scurry. What do you think he saw running away? A whole slew of enormous rats. Once we knew who the thieves were, we let Mushi sleep in the attic and never saw our uninvited guests again. At least not at night. A few evenings ago, it was 7:30 and still light. Peter went up to the loft to get some old newspapers. He had to hold on tightly to the trapdoor to climb down the ladder. He put down his hand without looking and nearly fell off the ladder from shock and pain. Without realizing it, he put his hand on a large rat which had bitten him in the arm. By the time he reached us, white as a sheet and with his knees knocking, the blood had soaked through his pajamas. No wonder he was so shaken. Petting a rat isn't much fun, especially when it takes a chunk out of your arm. Yours, Anne. Friday, March 12, 1943. Dearest Kitty, may I introduce Mama Frank, the children's advocate. Extra butter for the youngsters, the problems facing today's youth, you name it, and Mother defends the younger generation. After a skirmish or two, she always gets her way. One of the jars of pickled tongue is spoiled, a feast for Mushi and Bosch. You haven't met Bosch yet, despite the fact that she was here before we went into hiding. She's the warehouse and office cat who keeps the rats at bay in the storeroom. Her odd political name can easily be explained. For a while, the firm Geese & Company had 2 cats, one for the warehouse and one for the attic. Their paths crossed from time to time, which invariably resulted in a fight. The warehouse cat was always the aggressor, while the attic cat was ultimately the victor, just as in politics. So the warehouse cat was named the German, or Bosch, and the attic cat the Englishman, or Tommy. Sometime after that, they got rid of Tommy, but Bosch is always there to amuse us when we go downstairs. We've eaten so many brown beans and navy beans that I can't stand to look at them. Just thinking about them makes me sick. Our evening serving of bread has been canceled. Daddy just said that he's not in a very cheerful mood. His eyes look so sad again, the poor man. I can't tear myself away from the book A Knock at the Door by Ina Baker Boudier. This family saga is extremely well written, but the parts dealing with war, writers, and the emancipation of women aren't very good. To be honest, these subjects don't interest me much. Terrible bombing raids on Germany. Mr. Van Dan is grouchy. The reason? The cigarette shortage. The debate about whether or not to start eating the canned food ended in our favor. I can't wear any of my shoes except my ski boots, which are not very practical around the house. A pair of straw thongs that were purchased for 6.5 guilders were worn down to the soles within a week. Maybe Meep will be able to scrounge up something on the black market. It's time to cut Father's hair. Pim swears that I do such a good job he'll never go to another barber after the war. If only I didn't nick his ear so often. Yours, Anne. Thursday, March 18th, 1943. My dearest Kitty, turkeys entered the war. Great excitement. Anxiously awaiting radio reports. Friday, March 19th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, in less than an hour, joy was followed by disappointment. Turkey hasn't entered the war yet. It was only a cabinet minister talking about Turkey giving up its neutrality sometime soon. The newspaper vendor in Dam Square was shouting, "Turkey on England's side!" and the papers were being snatched out of his hands. This was how we'd heard the encouraging rumor. 1,000 guilder notes are being declared invalid. That'll be a blow to the black marketeers and others like them, but even more to people in hiding and anyone else with money that can't be accounted for. To turn in a 1,000 guilder bill, you have to be able to state how you came by it and provide proof. They can still be used to pay taxes, but only until next week. The 500 notes will lapse at the same time. Geese and Company still had some unaccounted 4,000 guilder bills, which they used to pay their estimated taxes for the coming years, so everything seems to be above board. Dussel has received an old-fashioned foot-operated dentist's drill. That means I'll probably be getting a thorough checkup soon. Dussel is terribly lax when it comes to obeying the rules of the house. Not only does he write letters to his Charlotte, he's also carrying on a chatty correspondence with various other people. Margot, the annex's Dutch teacher, has been correcting these letters for him. Father has forbidden him to keep up the practice, and Margot has stopped correcting the letters, but I think it won't be long before he starts up again. The Führer has been talking to wounded soldiers. We listened on the radio, and it was pathetic. The questions and answers went something like this. "My name is Heinrich Scheppel." "Where were you wounded?" "Near Stalingrad." "What kind of wound is it?" 2 frostbitten feet and a fracture of the left arm." This is an exact report of the hideous puppet show aired on the radio. The wounded seemed proud of their wounds, the more the better. One was so beside himself at the thought of shaking hands, I presume he still had one, with the Führer that he could barely say a word. I happened to drop Dussel's soap on the floor and step on it. Now there's a whole piece missing. I've already asked Father to compensate him for the damages, especially since Dussel only gets 1 bar of inferior wartime soap a month. Yours, Anne. Thursday, March 25th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, Mother, Father, Margot, and I were sitting quite pleasantly together last night when Peter suddenly came in and whispered in Father's ear. I caught the words, "A barrel falling over in the warehouse," and "someone fiddling with the door." Margot heard it too, but was trying to calm me down since I turned white as chalk and was extremely nervous. The 3 of us waited while Father and Peter went downstairs. A minute or two later, Mrs. Van Dan came up from where she'd been listening to the radio and told us that Pim had asked her to turn it off and tiptoe upstairs. But you know what happens when you're trying to be quiet. The old stairs creaked twice as loud. 5 minutes later, Peter and Pim, the color drained from their faces, appeared again to relate their experiences. They had positioned themselves under the staircase and waited. Nothing happened. Then, all of a sudden, they heard a couple of bangs, as if 2 doors had been slammed shut inside the house. Pim bounded up the stairs, while Peter went to warn Dussel, who finally presented himself upstairs, though not without kicking up a fuss and making a lot of noise. Then we all tiptoed in our stockinged feet to the Van Dans on the next floor. Mr. Van Dee had a bad cold and had already gone to bed, so we gathered around his bedside and discussed our suspicions in a whisper. Every time Mr. Van Dee coughed loudly, Mrs. Van Dee and I nearly had a nervous fit. He kept coughing until someone came up with the bright idea of giving him codeine. His cough subsided immediately. Once again, we waited and waited, but heard nothing. Finally, we came to the conclusion that the burglars had taken to their heels when they heard footsteps in an otherwise quiet building. The problem now was that the chairs in the private office were neatly grouped around the radio, which was tuned to England. If the burglars had forced the door and the air raid wardens were to notice it and call the police, there could be very serious repercussions. So Mr. Van Dan got up, pulled on his coat and pants, put on his hat, and cautiously followed Father down the stairs, with Peter, armed with a heavy hammer, to be on the safe side right behind him. The ladies, including Margot and me, waited in suspense until the men returned 5 minutes later and reported that there was no sign of any activity in the building. We agreed not to run any water or flush the toilet, but since everyone's stomach was churning from all the tension, you can imagine the stench after we'd each had a turn in the bathroom. Incidents like these are always accompanied by other disasters, and this was no exception. Number 1, the Vestertora bell stopped chiming, and I'd always found them so comforting. Number 2, Mr. Foskell left early last night and we weren't sure if he'd given Beth the key and she'd forgotten to lock the door. But that was of little importance now. The night had just begun and we still weren't sure what to expect. We were somewhat reassured by the fact that between 8:15, when the burglar had first entered the building and put our lives in jeopardy, and 10:30, we hadn't heard a sound. The more we thought about it, the less likely it seemed that a burglar would have forced a door so early in the evening when there were still people out on the streets. Besides that, it occurred to us that the warehouse manager at the keg company next door might still have been at work. What with the excitement and the thin walls, it's easy to mistake the sounds. Besides, your imagination often plays tricks on you in moments of danger. So we went to bed, though not to sleep. Father and mother and Mr. Dussel were awake most of the night, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that I hardly got a wink of sleep. This morning, the men went downstairs to see if the outside door was still locked, but all was well. Of course, we gave the entire office staff a blow-by-blow account of the incident, which had been far from pleasant. It's much easier to laugh at these kind of things after they've happened, and Bep was the only one who took us seriously. Yours, Anne. P.S. This morning the toilet was clogged and Father had to stick in a long wooden pole and fish out several pounds of excrement and strawberry recipes, which is what we use for toilet paper these days. Afterward, we burned the pole. Saturday, March 27th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, we've finished our shorthand course and are now working on improving our speed. Aren't we smart? Let me tell you more about my time killers. This is what I call my courses because all we ever do is try to make the days go by as quickly as possible, so we're that much closer to the end of our time here. I adore mythology, especially the Greek and Roman gods. Everyone here thinks my interest is just a passing fancy, since they've never heard of a teenager with an appreciation of mythology. Well then, I guess I'm the first. Mr. Van Dan has a cold. Or rather, he has a scratchy throat, but he's making an enormous to-do over it. He gargles with chamomile tea, coats the roof of his mouth with a tincture of myrrh, and rubs mentholatum over his chest, nose, gums, and tongue. And to top it off, he's in a foul mood. Rauter, some German bigwig, recently gave a speech. All Jews must be out of the German-occupied territories before July 1st. The province of Utrecht will be cleansed of Jews, as if they were cockroaches, between April 1st and May 1st, and the provinces of North and South Holland between May 1st and June 1st. These poor people are being shipped off to filthy slaughterhouses like a herd of sick and neglected cattle. But I'll say no more on the subject. My own thoughts give me nightmares. One good piece of news is that the labor exchange was set on fire in an act of sabotage. A few days later, the county clerk's office also went up in flames. Men posing as German police bound and gagged the guards and managed to destroy some important documents. Yours, Anne. Thursday, April 1st, 1943. Dearest Kitty, I'm not really in the mood for pranks. See the date. On the contrary, today I can safely quote the saying, misfortunes never come singly. First, Mr. Kleiman, our merry sunshine, had another bout of gastrointestinal hemorrhaging yesterday and will have to stay in bed for at least 3 weeks. I should tell you that his stomach has been bothering him quite a bit, and there's no cure. Second, Bep has the flu. Third, Mr. Foskel has to go to the hospital next week. He probably has an ulcer and will have to undergo surgery. Fourth, the managers of Palmason Industries came from Frankfurt to discuss the new Opetka deliveries. Father had gone over the important points with Mr. Kleiman, and there wasn't enough time to give Mr. Kugler a thorough briefing. The gentleman arrived from Frankfurt, and Father was already shaking at the thought of how the talks would go. If only I could be there, if only I were downstairs, he exclaimed. Go lie down with your ear to the floor. They'll be brought to the private office, and you'll be able to hear everything. Father's face cleared, and yesterday morning at 10:30, Margot and Pim, two ears are better than one, took up their posts on the floor. By noon, the talks weren't finished, but Father was in no shape to continue his listening campaign. He was in agony from having to lie for hours in such an unusual and uncomfortable position. At 2:30, we heard voices in the hall, and I took his place. Margot kept me company. The conversation was so long-winded and boring that I suddenly fell asleep on the cold, hard linoleum. Margot didn't dare touch me for fear they'd hear us, and of course she couldn't shout. I slept for a good half hour and then awoke with a start, having forgotten every word of the important discussion. Luckily, Margot had paid more attention. Yours, Anne. Friday, April 2nd, 1943. Dearest Kitty, oh my, another item has been added to my list of sins. Last night I was lying in bed, waiting for Father to tuck me in and say my prayers with me, when Mother came into the room, sat on my bed, and asked very gently, "Anne, Daddy isn't ready. How about if I listen to your prayers tonight?" "No, Momsie," I replied. Mother got up, stood beside my bed for a moment, and then slowly walked toward the door. Suddenly she turned, her face contorted with pain, and said, "I don't want to be angry with you. I can't make you love me." A few tears slid down her cheeks as she went out the door. I lay still, thinking about how mean it was of me to reject her so cruelly, but I also knew that I was incapable of answering her any other way. I can't be a hypocrite and pray with her when I don't feel like it. It just doesn't work that way. I felt sorry for Mother. Very, very sorry, because for the first time in my life I noticed she wasn't indifferent to my coldness. I saw the sorrow in her face when she talked about not being able to make me love her. It's hard to tell the truth, and yet the truth is that she's the one who's rejected me. She's the one whose tactless comments and cruel jokes about matters I don't think are funny have made me insensitive to any sign of love on her part. Just as my heart sinks every time I hear her harsh words, that's how her heart sank when she realized there was no more love between us. She cried half the night and didn't get any sleep. Father has avoided looking at me, and if his eyes do happen to cross mine, I can read his unspoken words. "How can you be so unkind? How dare you make your mother so sad?" Everyone expects me to apologize, but this is not something I can apologize for, because I told the truth, and sooner or later Mother was bound to find out anyway. I seem to be indifferent to Mother's tears and Father's glances, and I am, because both of them are now feeling what I've always felt. I can only feel sorry for Mother, who'll have to figure out what her attitude should be all by herself. For my part, I will continue to remain silent and aloof, and I don't intend to shrink from the truth, because the longer it's postponed, the harder it will be for them to accept it when they do hear it. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, April 27th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, the house is still trembling from the after effects of the quarrels. Everyone is mad at everyone else. Mother and I, Mr. Van Dan and Father, Mother and Mrs. Van D. Terrific atmosphere, don't you think? Once again, Anne's usual list of shortcomings has been extensively aired. Our German visitors were back last Saturday. They stayed until 6. We all sat upstairs, not daring to move an inch. If there's no one else working in the building or in the neighborhood, you can hear every single step in the private office. I've got ants in my pants again from having to sit still so long. Mr. Foskel has been hospitalized, but Mr. Kleiman's back at the office. His stomach stopped bleeding sooner than it normally does. He told us that the county clerk's office took an extra beating because the firemen flooded the entire building instead of just putting out the fire. That does my heart good. The Carlton Hotel has been destroyed. 2 British planes loaded with firebombs landed right on top of the German officers' club. The entire corner of Faselstracht and Singel has gone up in flames. The number of airstrikes on German cities is increasing daily. We haven't had a good night's rest in ages, and I have bags under my eyes from lack of sleep. Our food is terrible. Breakfast consists of plain, unbuttered bread and ersatz coffee. For the last 2 weeks, lunch has been either spinach or cooked lettuce with huge potatoes that have a rotten Swedish taste. If you're trying to diet, the annex is the place to be. Upstairs they complain bitterly, but we don't think it's such a tragedy. All the Dutchmen who either fought or were mobilized in 1940 have been called up to work in prisoner of war camps. I bet they're taking this precaution because of the invasion. Yours, Anne. Saturday, May 1st, 1943. Dearest Kitty, yesterday was Dussel's birthday. At first, he acted as if he didn't want to celebrate it, but when Meep arrived with a large shopping bag overflowing with gifts, he was as excited as a little kid. His darling Lotje has sent him eggs, butter, cookies, lemonade, bread, cognac, spice cake, flowers, oranges, chocolate books, and writing paper. He piled his presents on a table and displayed them for no fewer than 3 days, the silly old goat. You mustn't get the idea that he's starving. We found bread, cheese, jam, and eggs in his cupboard. It's absolutely disgraceful that Dussel, whom we've treated with such kindness and whom we took in to save from destruction, should stuff himself behind our backs and not give us anything. After all, we've shared all we had with him. But what's worse, in our opinion, is that he's so stingy with respect to Mr. Kleiman, Mr. Foskell, and Bep. He doesn't give them a thing. In Dussel's view, the oranges that Kleiman so badly needs for his sick stomach will benefit his own stomach even more. Tonight, the guns have been banging away so much that I've already had to gather up my belongings 4 times. Today, I packed a suitcase with the stuff I'd need in case we had to flee, but as Mother correctly noted, where would you go? All of Holland is being punished for the workers' strikes. Martial law has been declared, and everyone is going to get one less butter coupon. What naughty children. I washed Mother's hair this evening, which is no easy task these days. We have to use a very sticky liquid cleanser because there's no more shampoo. Besides that, Mom's had a hard time combing her hair because the family comb has only 10 teeth left. Yours, Anne. Sunday, May 2nd, 1943. When I think about our lives here, I usually come to the conclusion that we live in a paradise compared to the Jews who aren't in hiding. All the same, later on, when everything is returned to normal, I'll probably wonder how we, who always lived in such comfortable circumstances, could have sunk so low. With respect to manners, I mean. For example, the same oilcloth has covered the dining room table ever since we've been here. After so much use, it's hardly what you'd call spotless. I do my best to clean it, but since the dishcloth was also purchased before we went into hiding and consists of more holes than cloth, it's a thankless task. The Van Dans have been sleeping all winter long on the same flannel sheet, which can't be washed because detergent is rationed and in short supply. Besides, it's of such poor quality that it's practically useless. Father is walking around in frayed trousers, and his tie is also showing signs of wear and tear. Mama's corset snapped today and is beyond repair, while Margot is wearing a bra that's 2 sizes too small. Mother and Margot have shared the same 3 undershirts the entire winter, and mine are so small they don't even cover my stomach. These are all things that can be overcome, but I sometimes wonder, how can we, whose every possession, from my underpants to Father's shaving brush, is so old and worn, ever hope to regain the position we had before the war? Sunday, May 2nd, 1943. The attitude of the annex residents toward the war. Mr. Van Dan, in the opinion of us all, this revered gentleman has great insight into politics. Nevertheless, he predicts we'll have to stay here until the end of 43. That's a very long time, and yet it's possible to hold out until then. But who can assure us that this war, which has caused nothing but pain and sorrow, will then be over, and that nothing will have happened to us and our helpers long before that time? No one. That's why each and every day is filled with tension. Expectation and hope generate tension, as does fear. For example, when we hear a noise inside or outside the house, when the guns go off, or when we read new proclamations in the paper. Since we're afraid our helpers might be forced to go into hiding themselves sometime. These days, everyone is talking about having to hide. We don't know how many people are actually in hiding. Of course, the number is relatively small compared to the general population, but later on we'll no doubt be astonished at how many good people in Holland were willing to take Jews and Christians, with or without money, into their homes. There are also an unbelievable number of people with false identity papers. Mrs. Van Dan. When this beautiful damsel, by her own account, heard that it was getting easier these days to obtain false IDs, she immediately proposed that we each have one made, as if there were nothing to it, as if Father and Mr. Van Dan were made of money. Mrs. Van Dan is always saying the most ridiculous things, and her pootie is often exasperated. But that's not surprising, because one day Carly announces, "When this is all over, I'm going to have myself baptized." And the next, "As long as I can remember, I've wanted to go to Jerusalem. I only feel at home with other Jews." Pim is a big optimist, but he always has his reasons. Mr. Dussel makes up everything as he goes along, and anyone wishing to contradict His Majesty had better think twice. In Albert Dussel's home, his word is law, but that doesn't suit Anne Frank in the least. What the other members of the Annex family think about the war doesn't matter. When it comes to politics, these 4 are the only ones who count. Actually, only 2 of them do. But Madame Van Dan and Dussel include themselves as well. Tuesday, May 18th, 1943. Dearest Kit, I've recently witnessed a fierce dogfight between German and English pilots. Unfortunately, a couple of Allied airmen had to jump out of their burning plane. Our milkman, who lives in Helvig, saw four Canadians sitting along the side of the road, and one of them spoke fluent Dutch. He asked the milkman if he had a light for his cigarette and then told him the crew had consisted of six men. The pilot had been burned to death, and the fifth crew member had hidden himself somewhere. The German security police came to pick up the four remaining men, none of whom were injured. After parachuting out of a flaming plane, how can anyone have such presence of mind? Although it's undeniably hot, we have to light a fire every other day to burn our vegetable peelings and garbage. We can't throw anything into the trash cans, because the warehouse employees might see it. One small act of carelessness and we're done for. All college students are being asked to sign an official statement to the effect that they sympathize with the Germans and approve of the new order. 80% have decided to obey the dictates of their conscience, but the penalty will be severe. Any student refusing to sign will be sent to a German labor camp. What's to become of the youth of our country if they've all got to do hard labor in Germany? Last night, the guns were making so much noise that Mother shut the window. I was in Pim's bed. Suddenly, right above our heads, we heard Mrs. Vandy leap up as if she'd been bitten by Mushi. This was followed by a loud boom, which sounded as if a firebomb had landed beside my bed. "Lights! Lights!" I screamed. Pim switched on the lamp. I expected the room to burst into flames any minute. Nothing happened. We all rushed upstairs to see what was going on. Mr. and Mrs. Vandy had seen a red glow through the open window, and he thought there was a fire nearby, while she was certain our house was ablaze. Mrs. Vandy was already standing beside her bed with her knees knocking when the boom came. Dussel stayed upstairs to smoke a cigarette, and we crawled back into bed. Less than 15 minutes later, the shooting started again. Mrs. Vandy sprang out of bed and went downstairs to Dussel's room to seek the comfort she was unable to find with her spouse. Dussel welcomed her with the words, "Come into my bed, my child." We burst into peals of laughter, and the roar of the guns bothered us no more. Our fears had all been swept away. Yours, Anne. Sunday, June 13th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, the poem Father composed for my birthday is too nice to keep to myself. Since Pim writes his verses only in German, Margot volunteered to translate it into Dutch. See for yourself whether Margot hasn't done herself proud. It begins with the usual summary of the year's events and then continues. As youngest among us, but small no more, your life can be trying, for we have the chore of becoming your teachers a terrible bore. We've got experience, take it from me. We've done this all before, you see. We know the ropes, we know the game. Since time immemorial, always the same. One's own shortcomings are nothing but fluff, but everyone else's are heavier stuff. Fault-finding comes easy when this is our plight, but it's hard for your parents, try as they might, to treat you with fairness and kindness as well. Nitpicking's a habit that's hard to dispel. When you're living with old folks, all you can do is put up with their nagging. It's hard, but it's true. The pill may be bitter, but down it must go, for it's meant to keep the peace, you know. The many months here have not been in vain, since wasting time goes against your grain. You read and study nearly all the day, determined to chase the boredom away. The more difficult question, much harder to bear, is, what on earth do I have to wear? I've got no more panties, my clothes are too tight, my shirt is a loincloth, I'm really a sight. To put on my shoes, I must cut off my toes. Oh dear, I'm plagued with so many woes. Margot had trouble getting the part about food to rhyme, so I'm leaving it out. But aside from that, don't you think it's a good poem? For the rest, I've been thoroughly spoiled and have received a number of lovely presents, including a big book on my favorite subject, Greek and Roman mythology. Nor can I complain about the lack of candy. Everyone had dipped into their last reserves. As the Benjamin of the Annex, I got more than I deserve. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, June 15th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, heaps of things have happened, but I often think I'm boring you with my dreary chit-chat and that you'd just as soon have fewer letters, so I'll keep the news brief. Mr. Foskell wasn't operated on for his ulcer after all. Once the doctors had him on the operating table and opened him up, they saw that he had cancer. It was in such an advanced stage that an operation was pointless. So they stitched him up again, kept him in the hospital for 3 weeks, fed him well, and sent him back home. But they made an unforgivable error. They told the poor man exactly what was in store for him. He can't work anymore, and he's just sitting at home,